This clip was recorded for the UK Wine Show. For more information about the UK Wine Show, you can go to ukwineshow.co.uk.
Hi, my name's Chris Scott and I'm here with Michelle Erland from Colliangelo & Partners. How are you, Michelle?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm very good indeed. What I want to talk about today is a little bit about your history and where you've come from and where you're going, because one of the things we often see in the wine trade is people join the wine trade, but they don't really see any sort of progression, or they think, oh, I'm just going to get stuck serving tables or whatever it is. And I'd really like to just tease out where you've come from, where you are now, and how it's all fitted together, and maybe what you think you'd like to be doing in the future. But before we do that, do you want to tell us a little bit about Colliangelo & Partners? Who are they?
Of course. So Colliangelo & Partners, we are the top PR agency in the United States for fine wine and spirits. We have our flagship offices in New York, but we also have an office in San Francisco, and we just recently opened one in Miami. So we are growing and very passionate about the industry.
And who are your partners? You were saying earlier, you may not have heard of Colliangelo, but you know our clients. Give me some who's who of clients.
So we have some phenomenal clients, especially here in Italy in the Italian wine space. So we do work with Lamberto Frescobaldi, and we work with a lot of institutions like Chianti Classico and Prosecco DOC, as well as Sicily DOC. So We get to work with both brands, but also the institutional bodies.
Colliangelo does sound Italian. And I had a look on the website, and there's a lot of Italian-sounding names in the sort of senior management. Are you guys originally Italian?
So the owners, they are a family, and they are Italian-American. And we also do have a lot of native Italians on that work with us as well. I think it adds to the knowledge that we can all share between the cultures. So,
okay, and you've got a number of Italian brands in there. Is there any Frenchy brands or Australian brands in there?
So we do work with Louis Roederer. I'm sure you know that brand. And we have some Spanish brands as well, like Marchese di Marietta. We work with Ramos Pinto, the port producer. And we have a lot of producers we, of course, work with in the United States, in Napa and Sonoma and other areas as well.
And what do you do with what's your role within Colliangelo & Partners?
Yeah, so I am a senior account supervisor. So I actually run the team in San Francisco. And the core of what I do is media relations. So I work a lot with the media, helping our clients, amplify their messages and get themselves into different publications, and also broadcasts and podcasts and things like we're doing right now.
Yeah. Lovely. Okay, so the reason I said I wanted to talk to you was mainly because you have started out on the shop floor,
mm-hmm.
haven't you?
So yeah.
I'm just interested to explore your sort of history, how you landed up where you are now. So when was the first time you had a glass of wine?
Well, it's interesting that you're asking, talking about exploring my history, because sometimes I wonder how I ended up here as well. So the first glass of wine that I ever had, I think, was at a family party, and I'm kind of ashamed to even admit what I tried.
What was it? Come on.
It definitely was, I think, like a white Zinfandel or something.
It's a gateway drug.
It is.
It's the one that everybody can drink when they don't know anything about wine.
Exactly. And my family does like to bring that up from time to time because they now see where I am. And they always remind me of what I used to prefer when I was just starting out.
Popular wines. A lot of people prefer them.
Exactly.
Cool. Okay. So how old were you then?
21.
21 when you had your first Sydney.
21.
Oh, my God. At least I was, like, sneaking my dad's rubbishy box wine when I was younger than that. Okay, cool. So what was the first wine role you've ever had?
So I did grow up working in restaurants. My first job, believe it or not, was coat check at 13. I was my neighbor owned a few steakhouses, and on the weekends, you know, I would do that to make some money. And then from there, I moved to host, and I was hostessing for a while, and then, of course, moved to server and then to the bar. And, you know, that's the first time I was around wine and spirits. But moving to the wine role came later when I started working for a restaurant and became the sommelier, and then moved to become a beverage director. So that's where I really got immersed in the world of wine.
Okay. How long were you working as a sommelier?
I worked as a sommelier for about 4 years before I became the beverage director.
And did you do any training before you became a sommelier, or afterwards, or what was the sort of the process of getting into being a sommelier?
Yeah, so, I mean, it happened naturally. I was working as a server, and fortunately, the restaurant I was working for, the team trained me to, you know, serve wine on the floor. But then I did go to a culinary school in Soho in New York, where they had a specific program that was a sommelier intensive program. So I went there after I got the job. Said, you know, you got to make sure you can figure out what you have to do.
Yeah,
so I did that. And then from there, I actually started studying with the Court of Master Sommelier, and I did the intro course and then the certified exam with them.
And that was while you were working as a sommelier?
Yeah.
Any good stories as a sommelier? Now, what was your favorite client or type of clients, perhaps?
Well, when I was working on the... You know, it's always tough to work on the floor, but I think every sommelier's had this, but you get some customers in that challenge your knowledge, especially as a female in the industry. So those were always, you know, not the most pleasant customers to serve.
It's always a bit true. But you only did that for 4 years, was it?
4 years, and then I started to actually buy the wine. So I was the beverage director for 2 years following that.
Okay.
So,
any additional training to go up to that, or
just
experience?
No, it was just one of those things where you're assisting the previous beverage director, and then the opportunity came when that beverage director left. The spot was open, and, you know, naturally it's easier for a lot of restaurants to move someone into that position than find someone new. So I was fortunate that I had that opportunity.
It's also nicer for a restaurant as well, because where you started out, you know, taking coats effectively, but you've got a nice progression within the business or within the sector as well.
Yeah.
I think that's one of the things a lot of people don't realize is that you're now working in PR, but there are progressions through the business in any type of restaurant, really, isn't there?
Yeah, there are. And I think also one thing I didn't realize at the time was you learn so much just from working on a restaurant floor. So a lot of what I do now and the skills I have now really came from being on that floor, talking to people, dealing with problems every single day that you can't control in the restaurant industry. So
beverage director, got the buying job. Everybody wants to be a buyer in the wine trade. Was it a flash restaurant, or was it more of a McDonald's style?
So it was a very large restaurant. It was in Chelsea Market. We did between 600 and 1,000 covers. It was an Italian restaurant.
A day, a week, or a year?
A day.
That's quite a lot.
Yeah, I don't know if you've ever been to Chelsea Market in New York,
no.
But it's very busy. I mean, we had a great list, and we had great food and a great chef. But it was definitely an eye-opening experience to be the buyer of a place that does that much volume.
What did you like the most about the role?
I think I really appreciated being trusted to create my own list for this company, they were a large brand. So, you know, that means everything that you do, their name is attached to it. So I think I really enjoyed that they gave me the opportunity to create my own list there.
Yeah. How old were you then?
29.
Really? You don't look 29 now.
Thank you. Red wine.
Red wine. No, honestly, I haven't had anything to drink. That's not my goggles. Okay. So you did that for 4 years or so?
2 years.
2 years as beverage director. And what happened after that? What, decided to leave or do something different?
Well, the restaurant actually closed because...
Not enough wine sales.
Not enough wine sales. No, it was a situation where the lease was up and another company bought the building. And I was very fortunate because the company I work for said, do you want to move to Italy? Okay. Yeah, sure. So I moved here and I actually lived in Verona for 2 years almost.
Mm-hmm. What were you doing here?
Still working for the company, so I did a little bit of everything with them. I helped with events. We had pop-up events in Milan. We had we actually did a pop-up Instagrammable grocery store in London, so that was a fun thing. So I really gained a lot of experience in marketing and communications with them and the opportunity when they brought me here to Italy.
You stayed with him for 2 years.
I stayed here for 2 years.
And did you learn the lingo?
I would like to think so. You know,
you do
I try.
You wave your hands around when you're talking.
I do.
So you must be Italian.
I do. I always say that when I speak Italian and they speak Italian back to me, I think I'm doing something right.
My wife's hilarious. She goes to France. She studied French at A-level. And whenever we go to restaurants in France, you know, she'll speak to them in French and they always respond in English.
Yeah. That's when you know.
Haven't quite mastered it.
Yeah.
Nice. Okay, so what did you do after that?
So I decided at that time, so this was in 2019, I decided, you know, I was ready for a new opportunity. I'd worked for this company for over 5 years. And so at the time, I just completed my MBA in food and beverage. So I was ready to take all these skills and go for it. So I applied to Colangelo & Partners. I got the job, and I like to say I'm very fortunate because I moved back home to New York right before COVID.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
So the universe was giving me a sign, I guess.
But you did the Quartermaster Sommeliers, and you've done some other wine courses.
Yes,
as well.
So I did the Italian Wine Ambassador course through Vinitaly International Academy here in Verona,
While you're here. We're actually at Wine to Wine. I forgot to mention that earlier, but yeah. Okay, so that's what you're doing here for 2 years as well as all these other activities.
Yeah, so I did get involved, you know, as much as I could and my schedule would allow, I would try to get involved with all the events and tastings and seminars that were happening within the Italian wine community, so...
Back to New York, you started working for a PR company.
Yes.
Did you start as, I think you said your role was in charge of a team in San Francisco, but did you go straight into that role? Or
no, not at all.
Did you claw your way up a busy bowl of PR?
I like the dramatics. No, I started as an account executive because I think, you know, I still had a lot to learn, right? Anytime you make a... take a new road, make a slight switch. There's always that period where you do have to learn the agency, you have to learn the industry, things like that. So I started as an account executive and worked my way up to where I am now.
Do you think your experience in retail helped you get the role? Do you, you know, because a lot of people go for PR jobs, and you know, at wine and PR, a lot of people find that type of thing quite attractive.
Yeah.
But it can be quite hard breaking into that type of role.
Yeah.
Especially if you've got very little experience. So how do you think your experience on the floor helped you with that?
Well, I think first and foremost, working on a restaurant floor is not easy. You some thick skin, you know, you can't take things personally, especially when you have customers that are upset about things that sometimes you're like, I'm really sorry. I Just yeah. nothing else you can say, you know.
Sometimes they're upset before they even arrive.
Exactly, exactly. You know, I remember we had an instance in the building where the fire alarm went off because there was an actual fire upstairs. Now, granted, New York City, there's, you know, the building was like 15 floors and there was an actual fire. And
I've been in lots of fire alarms, but I've never actually been in one where there was a fire.
There was a fire. And so I had to tell people, we got to leave. And someone, they didn't want to leave because their food just came. I said, well, we got to go. Like, take it with you, but you got to leave. So that, yeah, he was very upset that I made him leave. But, yeah, so I think, you know, working on the restaurant floor, it really, first of all, it gives you a sense of hard work. It gives you a sense of being a team player. I mean, you have to work together in a restaurant to all accomplish the same goal, which is to feed the customers and try to get them to leave happy. You're on your feet a lot, so it's physically demanding. It's emotionally demanding. So I think having that experience really puts you in a position to, you know, handle the tough world of PR. So,
and is the PR world pretty tough?
It can be sometimes.
How come?
Well, you know, you are essentially sometimes managing the perception, or you're managing, you know, messages. So we work with clients, we work with media, we work with trade. So there's a lot of moving parts. There's a lot of multitasking. And also in this day and age, we live, you know, in a 24/7 news cycle. So it's very, very quick, too.
What's the most tricky thing you've had to deal with in PR?
Hmm.
Yeah, see, this is the thing, isn't it? It's like, do you say the real thing and make my client look bad?
No, or no.
Of course
you
wouldn't say that, no.
No. I think, you know, the tricky thing will always be when you're managing a sensitive situation, because at the end of the day, you know, when someone's hurt, it's always, even on the restaurant, when someone's hurt, it's really hard to recover that situation. So actually, I'm speaking today at Wine to Wine on how to communicate during a crisis. So I think it's that's the most difficult thing, is when you know someone's hurt or something happened, how do you best communicate to mitigate the situation? And you know, there's not always a rainbow at the end.
Yeah.
You know? So, but again, I learned a lot of this working in the restaurant.
Yeah.
So.
One of the things that some of the other presenters have talked about is journalism. And you're on the other side. You're trying to get coverage for wine brands, positive coverage for wine brands.
Yeah.
But the whole world of communication has changed over the last 10 years.
Yeah.
You know, it used to be you spoke to a journalist, the journalist was the gatekeeper. Now they would hopefully do some research and get a story out of it. But there's this terrible thing called an influencer now, or a content creator, or whatever you want to call them. What's the difference between a journalist and a content creator or an influencer,
well,
from your point of view?
I want to say it's not a terrible thing. Though, you know, all influencers are not terrible. But definitely new channels have opened up for communication and new opportunities to reach your consumers, right? Because your consumers are not going to all be in one place. So, but I think that what has changed is what I mentioned before, you know, with this 24/7 news cycle and with the digital landscape being so quick, we have to be, as communicators for our clients, or if you're a brand that doesn't have a PR agency or publicist working with you, you have to be very quick and prepared to respond. Because, you know, if you don't respond or if you don't put information out there, most likely someone else is going to put that information out there.
Mm. And that may not be on the spin that you want.
It just may not be the truth sometimes, mm-hmm. you know, and I think that it's important for you to have control over your voice and your message. There's no reason anyone else should have control over it.
Yeah. Is it harder to work with journalists because, in theory, every journalist you ever talk to is, I'm completely independent, as they take a free jolly somewhere?
No.
They all do. I don't believe in the independence of journalism. I really don't. I think everybody's got a bias of some sort. But in theory, a journalist is supposed to be fairly independent.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas an influencer, they make their money by selling their influence, don't they?
Yeah, and I think, you know, you've seen a lot of changes on digital platforms. And, you know, there are consistently some updates where if an influencer is getting paid to do a promotion, now Instagram, for example, is requiring them to put a little disclaimer that they're being paid for that. When that didn't happen, it was kind of harder to see, you know.
Not everybody does it. I think Kim Kardashian got fined recently for effectively advertising, but not telling anybody that she was promoting them.
Exactly. So, you know, on that end, I think what the platforms are doing are trying to make sure it's more transparent.
Yeah. If an influencer says something off their own bat versus a paid ad, if you like, which one has, are people aware that there's a difference, or they have better traction because of one or the other, or?
Well, I think absolutely, and I think this is, you know, where the media comes into play, because earned media or third-party endorsement is always going to be, you know, the strongest thing you can have for your brand. It's great that you say, oh, you know, my wine is the best, of course. But if you have a respectable writer talking about the wine and they have the tasting notes, that third-party endorsement, people are going to say, okay, well, that person didn't have to say that.
Mm.
So they must have really enjoyed it. Same thing with social media. So if you have the paid-for thing, yeah, people, you know, might get noticed. The brand awareness, of course, will increase. But if someone just happened to have a bottle of wine and they taste it and say, oh, I love this wine, and they're not getting paid for it, people are gonna who are following them say, oh, well, she didn't have to do that. You know, it's a third-party endorsement.
As a PR person, obviously there's people who buy advertisement and media. And I normally think of PR as trying to bring in journalists or get them to... It's not free, because you end up paying someone a heap of money to get that third-party endorsement effectively. But do you guys pay influencers yourselves, or do you try and get influencers to do free endorsements or valuable third-party endorsements?
Yeah. So, you know, I'm not the expert at social media and influencer marketing, for sure. We have a whole digital team in New York and in California that handle this on a regular basis. But I think, you know, on a surface level, you have two different options. You do have campaigns where people are being paid and they have specific, you know, messaging and guidelines to follow. And then you have opportunities where people want to do it to build their own portfolio, and you don't have to pay them. They might, you know, want a ticket to a show or something that maybe is more of, you know, like a exchange of, I could say, assets or something. Yeah, exactly. So I think you have two options. I think they both can work well. But again, you'll have to have my social media team join next time.
Okay. And what I've liked here is we've gone through your career and we've talked about how, you know, even, you know, that hard work on the shop floor has leveraged into where you are now. Where do you see yourself maybe in 5 years' time down the track?
Yeah. So, you know, I definitely still see myself with the company I'm with now. I think there's a lot of room for me to grow in this position, but also with what I'm doing in terms of PR. And, you know, we're always looking to bring on new clients and things like that. So I do see myself here, but I might have to come back in 5 years and we'll have to do an update.
Okay, so you're not quite sure where you're heading longer term? You don't want to be a CEO of a FTSE 100 wine company or anything like that?
You know what I like about working for an agency is that I get to work on many different brands and many different campaigns. And I think, you know, for someone like me who, again, came from that restaurant floor where I was multitasking and always moving, I feel like I'm utilizing those same skills. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's never a dull day.
Cool.
Yeah. The only thing I would say is that, you know, especially if you're interested in entering the wine industry or working in wine, is there's so many different opportunities like working in wine communications that are not necessarily told to you at the beginning of your journey. So, you know, keep exploring, keep talking to people, come to conferences like Wine to Wine, and you'll be interested or probably pleased to see how many different options there are out there.
Excellent. All right then, Michelle, thank you very much.
Thank you.